Happy New Year, and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 4th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, coevolution between ants and the butterfly species, how the U.S. presidential candidates view science, as well as why that matters to the rest of the world, and quick decision-making by a little fish. All this and more, plus we read from your letters to science.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
In parts of Denmark, caterpillars feast within ant colonies, both on the ant brood itself and because the adult ants bring the caterpillar's food. That happens because the caterpillar, which later develops into a large blue butterfly, mimics the surface chemistry of the ant brood. So the adult ants think the caterpillar is one of their young. Sometimes this parasitism by many caterpillars wipes out an ant colony. But other times, ants are able to recognize the caterpillars as invaders and kill them. As David Nash and colleagues describe in a paper in this week's Science, the butterfly and ants are engaged in a kind of coevolutionary arms race. Nash works at the University of Copenhagen.
One of the major problems that people have had with evolution is that if you evolve always to get better and better, then at some point you run out of variation that can be used for evolution because you can become as good as possible. And one of the main cases where this can't occur is when you have parasites and hosts co-interacting. Parasites are always trying to better adapt to their host to parasitize them more effectively, whereas hosts are experiencing selection pressures to avoid being parasitized. So it means that there can be an ongoing evolutionary arms race between the parasite and host. There have been some previous studies on microscopic organisms showing that this can occur in the laboratory, but what we have here, I think, is one of the first cases where we have clear evidence that this has been happening out in the field. And what we've shown in this study is that there's a butterfly, the Alcon blue butterfly, which parasitizes two different ant species within Denmark. And it gets into the ant nests by mimicking the surface hydrocarbons, the surface chemicals that the ants have on their own brood.
So the wandering ants may pick up a caterpillar and bring it back and start feeding it.
Yes, that's right. The caterpillars first start developing on a food plant, but after they reach a certain stage, they leave the food plant and wait on the ground to be discovered by these ants, and they mimic these surface chemicals that the ants have on their own brood. So again, they're producing a signal which says, I'm an ant brood. And we've been able to show that the closer that mimicry is, the faster they are picked up by ants and taken back into the ant nest and put amongst the brood. And once they're there amongst the ant's own brood, they become highly virulent parasites. They eat some of the brood, and they will also get fed by the worker ants. And they'll get fed in preference to the ant's own brood. It's been suggested they might provide some sort of super stimulus as well, though we still need to look into that further.
Is any of this chemical mimicry and subsequent adoption of the caterpillar by the ants based on proximity, suggesting that the mimicry has something to do with the diet?
Actually, we don't think it has anything to do with the diet of the butterfly. Or do you mean from the diet of the ant?
Either.
Yeah, the two species of ant that are used as hosts in Denmark are actually very closely related to each other, and they, to a large extent, have very similar niches. They feed on similar types of food. They're both scavenging species, mostly. It's more in their social structure that they differ. So how the colonies are organized and how they pass on their genes to the next generation is different between the two ant species that they use as hosts.
Is one social structure more likely to take on the parasitic caterpillar than the other?
Well, we know that almost any ant within this group, within the Myrmica ants, will pick up a caterpillar and take it into the nest. But it's only within these two species that it will survive. And what we find in one species is that a certain proportion of caterpillars that are taken in will survive and develop, and that's whatever population you're looking at. In the other species, we find that it's a lot more variable. So there's some populations where caterpillars are taken in, but they never manage to survive or only survive at very low levels. Whereas other populations, they're very heavily parasitized by the caterpillars. So so that caterpillars will survive very easily, and they'll also have a major effect on those ant colonies. So it's more that one host species is parasitized at a relatively constant rate, whereas the other one is parasitized at a very variable rate. And what I think we've been able to show is a lot of that variation in parasitism is related to how common the ant is locally. And that probably is also fed back from the effect of the caterpillars. This is something we still haven't demonstrated yet, but we think in some areas the butterfly can actually suppress that ant colony so much that it becomes very rare and it's no longer worth exploiting for the butterfly. And then it tends to use the other ant species as a refuge while that other species recovers. One way you can put it is we have one species where the ant is exploited at a relatively constant rate, and we have another species which, when it's common, is exploited even more than you would expect, but when it's rare, it's hardly exploited at all.
What exactly was your hypothesis?
So our hypothesis, we had several hypotheses we wanted to test. The first one was whether the degree of mimicry actually resulted in caterpillars being taken in more readily and exploiting colonies more readily. So that was the first hypothesis which we found a clear support for, that the greater the degree of mimicry between the caterpillar and the host ant's own brood, the faster they were taken into ant nests. The second hypothesis was that we were expecting that there may be some co-evolution going on between the butterflies and their hosts. So we would get changes in the pattern of chemicals that both the hosts and the butterflies had on their surface as a result of this co-evolutionary arms race in mimicry. So in other words, our hypothesis was that in those colonies or those populations of the ant which were infected by the butterfly, we would get changes in their surface chemistry, which the butterflies would then also try to match. Whereas in areas where the butterflies weren't present, we would not get any changes in the surface chemistry of the ants. And what we found for one species, our hypothesis was supported. We got arbitrary changes in the surface chemistry and the chemicals on the surface of, or the ratios of the chemicals on the surface of the ant brood. But in the other species, the one that was exploited at a relatively constant rate, we didn't get that pattern. And we believe that's because there was a lot of gene flow in that second species from neighboring colonies which are not infected, which essentially dilute any adaptation to the butterfly.
This was the different social structures that you mentioned.
This is the different social structures that I was talking about, yes. So because the second species, the one that's exploited at a more or less constant rate and doesn't seem to adapt to the butterfly, has what we call a panmictic structure, there seems to be a lot of gene flow over even relatively large distances, then we get no local adaptation to the butterfly. The other species, which tends to reproduce by budding, which means that neighboring colonies tend to be very highly related to each other, in that species we have much greater possibility for local adaptations within the ants. And so that is the species in which we find the pattern that they are changing their surface chemistry in response to the parasitism by the butterflies, and in some cases they seem to be avoiding parasitism that way. So our third hypothesis we tested, if you like, was that the differences we had in whether the ant species responded to the butterfly or not were because of the social structure and gene flow and the genetic viscosity of the populations, as it's been called. So in other words, how easily genes are transferred over a large distance over several generations.
And it doesn't sound as if the ants that are budding are getting much of this gene flow. They're highly viscous.
Yeah, so they're highly viscous. So our hypothesis for why we would get local adaptation in one species rather than the other was that the species in which we were finding the local adaptation would have much more viscous populations than the other. And that was confirmed when we did some genetic analysis using microsatellite markers to look at the viscosity of the different populations.
David Nash is lead author of a paper on a mosaic of chemical coevolution in a large blue butterfly. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, the cosmic web. When you look at the night sky, it appears as a vast darkness with stars, galaxies, and enormous clouds of gas. But that picture does not account for what we cannot see, dark matter and dark energy. Tying the seen and unseen all together is a larger connective structure that astronomers call the cosmic web. This week, Science presents a special issue on the subject, illuminating the efforts of astronomers to untangle the cosmic web and the stars, galaxies, nebulae, and other pieces of the universe embedded within it. Read several perspectives and a news story on the cosmic web in this week's Science. In November of this year, the citizens of the United States will elect a new president. While voters rightly focus on mega-issues such as war, immigration, and taxes, that does not mean the candidate's views on science should be out of the picture. As Science's deputy news editor Jeffrey Mervis explains how the next U.S. president views such topics as stem cell research, nuclear power, and global climate change will have a profound impact on the U.S. and the rest of the world. Mervis edited a special news focus on the topic in this week's issue.
There are a lot of issues that the president deals with that affect not just U.S. science, but international science. Everything from climate change to international space station to nuclear waste disposal to genetically modified crops. Those are all issues that the U.S. takes a policy on, but not in a vacuum. They're done in conjunction with or in opposition to the positions that other countries take.
So how did you find what the views of the various presidential candidates were in working on this article?
Well, that was a difficult process because science isn't on the front burner for any candidate. That's not new in 2008. That's been true in every campaign. There are fundamental issues, the economy, taxes, immigration, healthcare, that take priority. But that's not to say science isn't important. So what we did was talk to the people who knew the candidates, who had worked with the candidates, listened to the candidates on the campaign trail, in their speeches, talked with their advisors, and also looked at their backgrounds. That varied. You have people who are elected officials currently in the U.S. Senate or in the House of Representatives, in the governor's mansions around the country, former governors, former mayors, and to a greater or lesser extent, they've had some contact with the scientific community and have dealt with these issues, although sometimes within a scope that's much more narrow than they would deal with as president.
Have any of the candidates come out with any sort of position papers on any of these issues, even, say, global warming, which has been really advocated strongly by former Vice President Gore?
Well, the candidate that probably has had the most comprehensive position is Senator Clinton from New York. That's not surprising, given that she spent 8 years as First Lady when her husband was president. And as a result, she has a network of advisors that is probably much more extensive than any other candidate. That's not to say that she spent more time as senator on science and technology issues. It's just that the people around her are more familiar with the issue, and she is obviously receptive to those ideas and feels that it's important. She gave a major speech on the 50th anniversary of the launching of Sputnik back in October that really it was a more detailed presentation of the issue than any of the candidates have given. Global warming, of course, is probably the biggest issue that's science-related on the campaign. But even there's not a lot that you can use to distinguish the candidates within each party. Pretty much all of the Democrats have taken a position in support of large, dramatic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by some year, in this case, mostly 2050, and also a cap-and-trade system that imposes limits on how much carbon you can emit and charges for it and collects billions of dollars in revenues, which can then be used in various ways to try to come up with alternatives. That's for the Democrats. For the Republicans, pretty much they have stayed away from that issue, with the exception of John McCain, who for many years has made that one of his important planks. The other candidates, Rudy Giuliani, Mitt Romney, have not had a lot to say, and what they have had to say is not much different than the current administration. So within the parties, it's not going to be a litmus test. But that will change in the general election.
Well, you mentioned that global climate change is one of the issues in which a Republican differs from his party in how he views it. Is there a issue within the Democrats in which one Democrat differs from all the others?
Not really. And I don't mean to duck that question. One issue, again, that all of the Democrats have mentioned in one form or another is something that goes by the phrase politicization of science. This comes out in different forms on climate change, on endangered species, on other issues that are on use of embryonic stem cells in research, on issues that are in some ways ethical, philosophical, as much as technical and scientific. And the Democratic candidates have all said, in effect, we won't let this happen. But, of course, to some extent, that's a political football. You can go back to previous administrations, and a favorite campaign tactic is for the party out of office to say, we won't let this happen. In our administration, things will be different. But that's also an example of how when someone takes office, that's when the hard decisions have to be made, and that's when scientists want to be involved. But by then, it may be too late. So it's important for scientists to keep in mind that while the election is going on, that's an opportunity to have some input into the candidates' campaigns and try to stay up on the issues and be in touch with their advisors. Because once whoever wins in November takes office, then they will bring a whole new set of people into the political arena. And that's when things will actually start happening that affect scientists on a day-to-day basis.
Well, has there been in the past evidence that this kind of stepping up by scientists to make themselves and their issues aware to the presidential candidates during the election had an impact so that scientists doing so this year will have an impact before November?
I think it's hard to pinpoint a specific issue that where scientists made a difference in what a candidate once elected did. But I think that there are some things that scientists can give a slightly higher profile to. The issue of visa restrictions after 9/11 in 2001 is one such issue. I think within the context of homeland security and anti-terrorism, it wasn't a big concern. But I think the scientific community as a whole, from both spectrums, made a point of telling the policymakers and the powers that be that make sure you don't go so far to slam the door that you cut off the inflow of talent that has helped make this country such a strong scientific force. And I think that that had some effect at the highest levels. It wasn't a political issue. It wasn't a partisan issue. So it wasn't something that the policymakers already had a position on. I think that's a case where there's some fluidity in the system where scientists as a whole can make a case and argue for something that's in the best interests of the country, not just in the best interests of scientists and researchers.
What about what the candidates aren't saying?
Well, that's an important question because there's lots of things that they're not talking about in Iowa, in New Hampshire, and in the upcoming primaries, because they're not issues that candidates are going to make a decision on. But come 2009, they're going to be important. Things like the future of NASA and the role of nuclear power in trying to move away from a fossil fuel economy. How to continue to keep the U.S. economy on the cutting edge, encourage innovation. Not something the candidates are talking much about. But they're going to have to make some pretty important and lasting decisions. It was interesting going back to previous election packages that we have run. And in 2000, when Al Gore and George W. Bush were running, the question of the R&D tax credit, which is meant to foster innovation, was raised. And both of them said they thought it should be made permanent. Well, 8 years later, you can hear the same thing on the campaign trail, because that's something that people agree is important, but somehow when you start to add up the numbers, it doesn't happen. So that there are issues that don't go away, And those are going to have to be dealt with. That's why it's important to be familiar with not just the candidate, but who's around the candidate, because those are the people that are going to get the senior positions. Science Magazine also recently took a look at the top science advisors in the Bush administration and predicted that almost none of them will survive into the next administration. That means, for better or worse, that the positions such as director of NIH, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the head of the Office of Science at the Department of Energy, in all likelihood, the heads of NASA and possibly the National Science Foundation will have new faces. And who those people will be will go a long way in determining what U.S. science policy is in the next administration, regardless of who the president is.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis edited a special news focus on how the U.S. presidential candidates view scientific issues. You can read the full set of articles in the January 4th issue of Science. Also this week in Science, the biological processes that regulate human growth. Anita Rausch and colleagues have shown that mutations in the centrosomal pericentrin, or PCNT, gene cause a rare growth condition known as microcephalic osteodysplastic primordial dwarfism type 2. This inherited condition is characterized by a small brain and body size, but near normal intelligence. The findings may provide researchers with insights into the biological processes that regulate human growth. In addition, the researchers suggest that the Homo floresiensis, or hobbit fossils, may have had this genetic condition. Read the paper, Mutations in the Pericentrin Gene Cause Primordial Dwarfism, at www.scienceexpress.org. When hunting prey, the archer fish makes extremely quick decisions. Understanding that quick process may help researchers in understanding the more complex decision-making of higher vertebrates, including people. In a paper in this week's Science, Stefan Schuster and Thomas Schlegel identified what is the minimum input the archer fish needs to make its decisions about catching its prey. The fish sees and starts to move in the direction of its prey in under 40 milliseconds, which is just about the time it takes for a single frame of a movie to flash by. I spoke with Schuster from his office at the Universität Erlangen-Nuremberg in Germany.
What we were most interested in this paper is to find a system that performs a complex task at a very high speed, so high that only a very restricted small or compact neural circuitry can be involved. And the advantage of having such a system would be, we thought, that you can tackle the complexity of the system much better than, for instance, in the cortex, where you can apply functional resonance imaging technology that gives you only coarse resolution and where you have no access to the circuitry at the cellular level. So what's interesting, in my opinion, about this archerfish work is that here a fish performs a very complex decision, and the fish then must decide what kind of motor output to produce. And the interesting thing is that this decision, which is really complex, is made in only 40 milliseconds or less than 40 milliseconds, and can be related, or a large part of it is made by a circuitry that's very nicely accessible that fish do have, so that I think we really have here a handle to study complex decision making at the level of identified and small cellular networks.
Why is the archer fish making this decision? What task is it trying to accomplish?
Yeah, well, archer fish, very opportunistic hunters that are famous for their ability to shoot down aerial prey, insects, or even up to small lizards from leaves or twigs above the water surface with a precisely aimed shot of water which they release from their mouth. And since they hunt in groups and are surrounded by lots of other surface-feeding fish, they must be really fast at the later point of impact of their dislodged prey. And so it's very important for them to monitor the initial motion of the dislodged prey and then to be already on the right track towards the later impact point, so to be at the later point of impact at the right time.
Why wouldn't this just count as instinct? Why is this a complex decision?
Yeah, it's a decision because the combination of variables in order to know how much to turn and at what speed to take off, the fish must take into account, as we now know, four independently varying variables the initial height of the prey, its initial speed, vertical and horizontal, and the direction, the azimuthal direction of the prey. And these are variables which the fish cannot know before, and in fact, as we show in the paper, about which it doesn't have or doesn't use any a priori information. So the fish just must view the initial motion and take this information about direction, speed, and height from this initial observation, and then decide on the turning angle. Just one turning angle or just one speed wouldn't do, and the amount of combinations of the initial motion variables are just too many to be stored or to be inherited.
Is this a learned response?
Yes. Young fish first have to learn to get the response right. And there is a nice finding that shows that it's plastic, because the rapid response of the fish to the initial motion of this large prey goes away when you isolate the group members. It goes away when the competition is taken away from the fish. If you isolate them, then this fast response to the initial motion goes away and the fish will wait until the prey falls down or splashes on the water and then respond only then. And if you take the isolated fish together afterwards, put them together as a group, then the response, the rapid response and the competition will come back again.
So your experimental setup then was various targets and things like that for the archer fish to shoot at in groups. How did that work exactly?
So the basic setup was, our first intention was to show what kind of information the fish really do use or do need to be so rapid. The first idea we had is that because in the natural situation, before the prey moves, there is a shot. One fish will fire its shot of water towards the target, and the other fish, as well as the shooter itself, could use the information. For instance, observing the shot would tell the fish, or could tell the fish, the timing when motion needs to be observed. It could tell also the fish where motion is going to take place, because the fish know the spot where the insect initially was. And it could even tell the fish perhaps what kind of trajectory, what kind of speed would be most likely given the way the water approaches or the angle from which the water approaches the fly. So the first set of experiments we did was just to deprive the fish of this possibility. And this experiment was very simple. We put the fly, a dead fly, immobile, on the top of a non-transparent disc, and from which the fly could be blown off within a stream of air at any speed and at any direction. So for the fish in this situation, the fish couldn't see a fly, and suddenly a fly started moving at a given speed or direction, which we, as the experimenters, commanded. So in this situation, there was no shot to observe, and there were no cues available that the fish could exploit to direct in responses. And surprisingly, in this situation where the fish was deprived, they were just as fast and as accurate as in the more natural situation where they would have all sorts of a priori information available. That was really surprising, because it tells that motion cues were both necessary and sufficient to drive this rapid response. And this is an important step in our chain of arguments in this paper.
Is that short time of 40 milliseconds that accounts for the number of neurons that must both receive a signal and fire before the fish can act? Or is there some other mechanism at play here?
Mm-hmm. The sort of evidence which one needs to conclude from our findings on the kind of circuitry that is involved in making this complex decision, there are two kinds of information we need. First is that the response takes only 40 milliseconds and does not need any a priori inputs. The second piece of information comes from work which we published before, which shows that the responses the fish make to falling prey is just the same as the kind of escapes the fish make when they are startled. And the escape circuitry of teleost fish is very well known.
Teleost fish?
Fish that have a backbone.
Okay.
In contrast to sharks and rays, for instance.
Okay.
And this has been shown by a large variety of wonderful studies to involve the huge Mautner cells. The Mautner cells are not shown, we have just shown them to be present in archerfish, but this is not in the paper already. And the fine thing about this circuitry is that the initial decision is made by a small number of neurons. The motor neurons, for instance, they come in two. There are two for each teleostfish. There are, or for most of the teleostfish, there are only two motor cells per fish. And these are huge neurons which you can identify from individuum to individuum. And there are serial homologous cells to the motor cells. And there's this rather small and yet tractable number of reticulospinal neurons probably also involved in the response. Now to the 40 milliseconds, it's known that the fastest goldfish, it is known that the fastest way to a muscle contraction that is visually elicited, it takes 35 milliseconds. So the direct path from phototransduction to the tectum of the fish and then down to the fastest way of getting a muscle contraction takes 35 milliseconds. And now if you allow the archerfish only 5 milliseconds to look at the initial motion, certainly it will need more in order to judge what the initial speed and direction and height is, then the time is consumed already, which means that most of the decision must be done. Well, probably the information is provided by the retina, and then it's just relayed to the fast output system that fish have.
Stefan Schuster, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Stefan Schuster is senior author of a paper on high-speed decision-making in archerfish. Read the paper in this week's Science. Finally today, we read from some of your letters to Science. Joining me is the journal's letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
In December, we published several letters in response to news and editorials. The first we read from today is in response to a September 7th news story on virtual worlds that was part of a special section on social cognition.
Greg Miller's news story on how scientists were using virtual worlds to conduct their research prompted Alessandra Gorini to write in from the Applied Technology for Neuropsychology Laboratory at the Istituto Axologico Italiano in Milan.
Online communities are playing an emerging role in health services. And recent evidence has shown that reality-based treatments effectively combat anxiety disorders and allow subjects to develop real-world skills, starting from virtual experiences.
These successes raise the possibility of creating online immersive therapeutic environments for specific disorders, particularly social phobias. For example, Gorini suggests using a virtual pub. In this virtual equivalent of a real-world pub, a therapist can monitor the patient's interactions with the other patrons.
You can read Gorini's letter in the December 7th issue of Science. Turning now to the December 14th issue, a response to Donald Kennedy's editorial, Sputnik Nostalgia, from the October 5th issue.
In that editorial, Kennedy, Science's editor-in-chief, writes about the positive effects that the launch of Sputnik 50 years ago had on science education in the United States.
But upon reflection about NASA, which also came about, in part, due to Sputnik's launch, Michael Goldstein from Rutgers University in New Jersey says that he is disappointed. Although funding for NASA programs may have increased briefly, it dried up soon after the Apollo moon landing.
Goldstein adds, lately, NASA has received additional funding to attempt a second series of missions to the moon as part of the Constellation program. But the long-awaited increase is the bittersweet result of an imaginary space race. It seems that only when faced with the threat of looking stupid or coming in second place does our government open its wallet to science.
Also from the December 14th issue, William Lawrence writes in from the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama about the relationship between U.S. soy subsidies and Amazonian deforestation.
The United States is the world's leading producer of soy. However, many U.S. farmers are shifting from soy to corn or maize in order to qualify for generous government subsidies intended to promote biofuel production.
In turn, this is helping to drive a major increase in global soy prices, which have nearly doubled in the past 14 months. That has important consequences for Amazonian forests and savanna woodlands, with studies suggesting a strong link between Amazonian deforestation and demand for soy.
Lawrence writes, the environmental benefits of corn-based biofuels might be considerably reduced when its full and indirect costs are considered.
Finally, a reader writes in about a News of the Week story from November 9th, Postdoc survey finds gender split on family issues.
Udijit Bhattacharjee wrote that story describing a survey of postdocs at the National Institutes of Health. The survey suggests that the main concern for women is not a hostile environment, but insufficient time to juggle the needs of family and career.
From the psychology department at Richard Stockton College in New Jersey, Jean Mercer writes about her own balancing act throughout her career.
While special programs came about to encourage women who had delayed professional education until their families were grown, there was little help for those who had been juggling family and career all along.
As Mercer recalls, "Looking back on a career as a professor and a single parent, I missed out on networking with colleagues and on presenting at conferences because of family obligations. I continued to miss out on these aspects of my career for many years because, as most parents know, children can be too old to be left alone, as well as too young."
Now an emerita and consultant, Mercer says the internet has helped her develop connections, particularly now as her family tasks are minimal.
She adds that young professional women today are more likely to benefit from electronic communication than from changes in social attitudes about family responsibilities.
You can read her full letter in the December 21st issue of Science. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor for Science Magazine. If you enjoyed this letter segment of the podcast and would like to hear more or have other comments about this segment or the podcast itself, please let us know. You can send your comments to our email address, sciencepodcast@aaas.org. And that wraps up the January 4th, 2008 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.